my partner at the paper, Jim Reise, and I began hearing rumblings, really, about some mysterious intelligence program in the government. What President Bush had done was to claim the power to order wiretaps of Americans in their international communications without a court order.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Eric Lichtblau, who since 2002 has been a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, where he covers the Department of Justice. He grew up in the Syracuse area and attended Cornell University. And after graduating from Cornell, he spent 15 years at the Los Angeles Times. He came to the New York Times shortly after 9/11, and his reporting on the activities of the Department of Justice since the 9/11 attacks, especially his exposure of the NSA's wiretapping program in 2005, and how he got the stories of that and the price that he and his newspaper paid for running those stories, are summarized in his very thoughtful book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Please welcome Eric Lichtblau.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, George, for that kind introduction. It's great to be here in the spotlight, literally. May have to borrow your sunglasses if it gets too much glare there. But it was an interesting ride down. I was listening to Fox News Radio. I don't know why exactly. I'm into sort of the self-abuse. And Glenn Beck, one of their commentators, was going on and on about the media and how despicable and evil and distorted they are in trying to tear down Sarah Palin. And many of you probably heard Sarah Palin the other night. And we were the media, seemed to be her favorite pinata for the night to rile the crowd. All she had to do was mention the word media, and there would just be instantaneous booing. And it's a fascinating time to be a reporter in the spotlight. I've been a reporter for now about 20 years, first with the Los Angeles Times, now the New York Times. And I never remember a time quite like the last few years where the media has really been held to such scrutiny. And I don't say that in a self-pitying way, but more in a sort of, it's a fascinating and really awe-inspiring way that the media has now become such a big part of the story in American life, in our political culture, with the advent of blogs who are sort of looking over our shoulder constantly in the mainstream media. They call us the MSM. That's their shorthand pejorative for us at the New York Times and the Washington Post, is the MSM. You know, they're looking over our shoulders, pushing stories that they think we've ignored. We have folks on the left who think that we are not aggressive enough with the administration. We have folks on the right who think we're too critical, who think we're exposing national secrets, jeopardizing national security. And it's really a time of just constant self-awareness and self-scrutiny about what our role is in public discourse. And since 9/11, I think that a lot of these issues have just come into really sharp relief, because we are living in such a turbulent time, the age of terror, as George Bush likes to call it. And the media has been forced to make decisions about what to publish, about what areas to investigate, really unlike any in the last 30 years. You got to go back to the Vietnam era and the battle over the Pentagon Papers at my newspaper to find sort of parallels to these often gut-wrenching debates that we've had at the newspaper. So my hope today is to just sort of start a dialogue with you all and tell you a little bit about life in the fishbowl, really, as a Washington reporter for a major newspaper, and give you some insight into that and take whatever questions you may have, which is usually the interesting part, I find. I think it's easy with these issues that we talked about the last couple of years over what the media should and should not be reporting. For instance, the NSA wiretapping program is my sort of 15 minutes of fame the decision by the newspaper to publicize the secret program that President Bush had authorized to allow the NSA, the National Security Agency, to wiretap without warrants. That was an agonizing process. I'll get into it a little bit more later. An agonizing process for the newspaper, and the editors actually held that story, as you may know, for about 14 months at the urging of the White House, which said that this story would do grave harm to national security. And they made very clear to us directly, I was in the room for meetings with the highest officials, who said, if you run this story, there will be blood on your hands at the time of the next attack. The New York Times will share the responsibility with the administration for why we didn't stop the next attack. Those are, decisions that, I never thought that I would face as a reporter. And I think it's easy to forget, given that context, the last few years, stories like the NSA wiretapping and torture and Guantanamo Bay and a whole host of stories I'll get into a little bit later, where the newspaper has faced this, the media has faced this dilemma over the public's right to know versus national security. It's easy to forget in that context just how different the climate was immediately after 9/11 for the media. So let me take you back a little bit there and talk about that a bit. After 9/11, 7 years ago now, 7 years ago this coming week, there was quite understandably just a national mood of horror and revulsion over what had happened. And for a time, the country really came together. That was, as I talk about in my book, that was sort of George Bush at his best, standing on the fire truck at Ground Zero, with a firefighter's helmet on, and speaking to people one-on-one with a sort of emotional gut appeal that, to be honest, he does very well as a politician, and unifying the country and bringing the country together. And we in the media we're part of that. We're attacked as traitorous sometimes, or just trying to bring down the government, or pick an adjective, pick a label. But I think after 9/11. And, reporters felt, we were citizens first. I know that sounds cliched, but there was certainly a feeling that the media had to do its part to stop the next attack. There had been so much information out there and so much discussion about all the dots that were missed before 9/11 by the CIA and the FBI and the NSA. The media was as hot on the trail as anyone else after 9/11 to try and glean what the next big attack might be. And for the first couple of years after 9/11, that was the story for reporters like myself who cover the Justice Department or the FBI, the CIA, intelligence. All the focus, all the energy, all the oxygen was on looking at the next threat. And in hindsight, there was not really the skepticism that we usually bring to our jobs. And I say that with full responsibility and full acceptance that we did fall down on the job in a lot of ways. It was very easy for reporters like myself to get sort of a scoop about the next big threat. The FBI puts out these things called inlets, which are secret reports, although they're sent out to thousands of local law enforcement and state sheriffs and things like that. They're not all that secret. And these came out by the dozens after 9/11. First privately and then very publicly, where they would warn about every possible threat and intelligence that had been gotten from some guy in Afghanistan who warned that crop dusters were going to be used to spread biochemicals over the fields of Iowa, or scuba divers might be used to attack from the Pacific in California, or helicopters might be used from to use tourist traps as attacks for the next vehicle in New York City. And we wrote stories like that, really getting them on the front page for months and months after 9/11. Again, remembering the climate that we were in there. This was not done in any way, I don't think, to necessarily consciously scare people. It wasn't as if, I think people look at this and say, oh, the media, is intentionally hyping or intentionally buying into things that were not true. That was not the feeling, certainly, of any reporter that I know. There was a feeling that we just missed all the signals that led to the most horrific attack on American soil ever. And we need to do a better job of informing the public of what is out there. And when the FBI or the CIA says, you know, they're going to use scuba divers, or they're going to use crop dusters, or they're going to use tourist helicopter planes to attack, I think we felt, and I felt, that it was our responsibility to push that information out to the public. Did it have the effect of probably scaring people and raising alarms needlessly? In hindsight, absolutely. But I think, again, you have to remember the time and the climate that we were in. We gradually became, it took us a little while, a couple of kicks in the pants to get us there, but I think we gradually sort of regained our skepticism. You know, reporters have an inherent ability to distrust everyone. You know, if you're too trusting as a journalist, you're probably in the wrong business. There's an old joke that, you know, if your mother tells you she loves you, you know, get a second source to confirm it. You know, and that is the mindset of journalists, and that did certainly abandon us for the first year or two after 9/11. I remember one experience where I was covering a congressional hearing with John Ashcroft. This was around 2003 when he was then the Attorney General. He dropped this bombshell into his congressional testimony. He very dramatically had just unsealed grand jury records that had been sealed for months and months, and announced that this mosque in Brooklyn was tied to Al-Qaeda and was involved in a plot to funnel millions of dollars to Al-Qaeda and apparently Osama bin Laden himself. And this was, as I said, quite a bombshell. I remember running out of the hearing room before Ashcroft even finished his testimony and getting on the phone to our news desk, you know, because they were about to go into their front page meeting telling me, hold a spot on the front page. It was like, you know, the old movies, the old black and white movies. You know, stop the presses almost. And you know, sure enough, the story led the paper the next day in the New York Times, and many papers like it. You know, mosque in Brooklyn tied to millions in Al-Qaeda fundraising, or something along those lines. And I remember getting into a bit of a tussle with one of my colleagues in New York, a reporter in Brooklyn, who covered this local community and was looking at the same grand jury testimony and indictments that I was, and said, you know, didn't we hype this story too much? Is there really evidence that this little mosque in Brooklyn was tied to Osama bin Laden? You know, I feel naive in hindsight saying this, but I said, look, they just unsealed grand jury records. They have a confidential informant. They have witnesses, grand jury testimony, you know, a secret money laundering plot. You know, the attorney general himself announced it, and you know, you're doubting whether it's true. And this was a fairly awkward situation, and I was forced to admit, about a year later, after the facts of the case began to dribble out and the case actually went to court, that our reporter in Brooklyn was absolutely right to doubt the facts of the case. The connection to Al-Qaeda disappeared. There was, in fact, a cleric from Yemen who was raising money for militant groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, who had a sort of tangential tie to Brooklyn in this mosque. By the time he was convicted for this fundraising effort overseas, there was no discussion of Al-Qaeda. There was virtually no link to Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden, and those early headlines really were, you know, made of whole cloth. And it was incidents like that that made you realize, you know, we need to take a step back and we need to regain our footing and do what we're here to do, which is to ask the tough questions and ask often the unpopular questions. You know, when you see incidents like that mosque in Brooklyn, when you see cases like that of Jose Padilla, you may remember, who was the dirty bomber, the radioactive dirty bomber, another case that Ashcroft, who was quite adept at using the media to his advantage, Ashcroft announced from Moscow, live from Moscow, if you remember seeing it, there was this eerie orange glow over his head, and he announced that the US authorities had just taken into custody this American from the hardscrabble streets of Chicago, a former gang member who was ready to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb spewing radioactive materials on the streets of America. And it was so over the top, I talk about this in my book too, that even the White House was upset about that one, and Ashcroft and the Justice Department got quite a tongue lashing for making this into such a, you know, imminent major threat. And that case, as with the Brooklyn case, by the time you actually begin to peel it back and it goes through the court process 2, 3, 4 years later, The final case looked nothing like the original case. There was Jose Padilla was in fact convicted with a couple of guys in Florida of offering material support through, mostly through phone communications to militant groups overseas. But there was nothing about a radioactive dirty bomb. The final case was almost unrecognizable from the original one. And I think that shift in mood among the media and the return to that skepticism came really around 2004. It's tough to, you know, you can't put a date on something like that, obviously, but the one turning point was the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq and the photos that came out there. That was a story that I think a year or two earlier the media would have been very, very hesitant to have run. I think that in that climate in 2002, 2003, there would have been compelling questions on the other side that the editors would have said, you know, should we be revealing interrogation tactics, for instance, in Abu Ghraib, what they're doing in Iraq. But by 2004, I think that we had been, I don't want to say duped, but I think that we had been misled in our reporting often enough that we were forced, drag kicking and screaming at times, to say, but wait, what about the other side here? What else is going on that we don't know? And beginning in 2004, we saw many stories about the tactics that the U.S. government was using in fighting the war on terror. We of course, were still covering the threat itself. I don't mean to suggest through any of my comments here that you know, the media and that I as a reporter don't view Al-Qaeda and militant Islamic extremism excuse me, as a threat. We covered that and we continue to cover that as a very real, very live issue. But we also began 3-4 years ago to cover the way the government was attacking the problem and the political side of the issue and the intelligence problems and the civil liberties and human rights issues that went along with that in ways that we were not doing in those first few years. Now, probably a lot of you are already thinking at this point about the parallel to the Iraq War and the buildup there. I'm I guess, glad to say that I was not directly involved in any of our coverage in those years, 2002, 2003, to the buildup in Iraq, but certainly there are obvious parallels of even greater importance to the media's role there. You know, we're accused by folks on the left who are opposed to the war, and not undeservedly, of buying into the administration's buildup, the run-up to the war. And my newspaper, The Times, has in fact took an official position in what we call an editor's note in probably about 2005 of saying that there were flaws and gaps in the newspaper's reporting in that time. Again, as I said earlier, I don't think, despite what some of our critics would have you believe, that this was intentional. I know probably some of you won't believe that you know, this is an issue where people will just disagree. But you know, I worked with Judy Miller, who's sort of become, I think, somewhat unfairly, the face of the media hype in Iraq. I work with Judy on stories unrelated to Iraq, a lot of them involving Al-Qaeda and CIA, Justice Department efforts, things like that. You know, I have no doubt that Judy believed in her reporting, as did many in the government, both Democrats and Republicans, that they would ultimately find WMD in Iraq. I don't believe, and I can't prove this, but I don't believe for a second, you know, that Judy ever was intentionally sort of buying into the hype just to sell papers, as people like to say, you know, for political ends. Did her reporting go too far? Was there were there times when there obviously should have been more skepticism? You obviously should have gone to experts to say, but what about this? Is the evidence as clear-cut as the U.S. believes? Who are the sources that are providing this information? And obviously, we've come to learn more and more about that. And the case, as with radioactive bomber and as with Brooklyn mosques, the more you learn about it, the more you pull at those threads, the case begins to unravel. And that's a natural and evolving process for the media. We can't know everything right off the bat, and we're now in a news cycle, a 24/7 news cycle, where we're in a position oftentimes where we have to put out what we know without necessarily every question being answered. There's no good option to that, unfortunately. You know, we hold back at times when the questions are so glaring that we can't in good faith go ahead with a story. But if there is a big breaking news story that everyone is talking about and people want answers to, you know, we're obviously compelled in the news business to put out as much as we know, then come back the next day and say, well, we told you yesterday, here's the other side, but here's something we didn't know. We're going through that right now with the anthrax investigation that a lot of you might have heard about, a huge story that broke about a month or so ago that I've been working on pretty extensively, where the government, out of the blue, had been investigating very closely a scientist at Fort Detrick who ultimately killed himself. You probably have heard the details. You know, that's a story where the government initially put out a very strong case implicating the Fort Detrick scientist, a guy named Bruce Ivins. You know, for all I know, he very well may have been the anthrax killer. Unclear at this point, I would say, but the more we learn, we sort of pull at those strands and say, okay, here's another side of the case. Here's the way the FBI went about investigating this case. Here's how they focused on the wrong person for 5 years, a guy named Dr. Stephen Hatfill, who just got a settlement of $5 million. And here's why perhaps this guy that the government says was absolutely the anthrax killer might possibly not have been, and if the case had gone to court, what would have happened? I mean, these are the issues that the media deals with every day when reporting and investigating very difficult, very complex issues that don't have easy solutions. And I know our readers, you know, always suspect bias and always believe that we have a motive behind this stuff other than just sort of ferreting out the truth. And I get that from both sides. My email box every morning is filled with people who, you know, who believe that we missed this, or we were too quick to believe this, or we were too quick to attack this position. And I get it from, I'd say almost more vitriol from the left than from the right, believe it or not, in terms of really personal attacks. You know, I wrote a story probably about 2 months ago on the congressional response to the NSA wiretapping and Congress's move to enact legislation that was more or less what the White House wanted. And this was a story that that looked at some of the difficulties the administration would have in intelligence gathering if the law expired, and what would happen if there was a gap in intelligence coverage. And oh boy, I got beat up from the left in that more than any story I think I've ever covered. I had gone from a traitor who exposed this National Security Agency program to now a flunky for the White House. And I sort of look in the mirror and say, I'm not sure how I can be both those people at once, but okay. You know, listening to these media attacks now the last few weeks on the political front from the Republicans, and listening to folks like Glenn Beck on the radio, and all the scrutiny that we're under, you know, it's sort of the opposite of Sally Field at the Oscars, if you remember her. It's like, wow, they hate us. They really hate us, you know. And again, I don't say that in a self-pitying way, but it's the realization that we in the media have to do a better job, I think, of being transparent about a lot of these things. We'd never been used to, historically at least, used to you know, having to get into the process, the sausage making of how stories come about. You know, that was a sort of insular process for newspapers for years and years and years. Now we have public editors and ombudsmen who really peel back that process and let readers in and know this is how we came to this conclusion. This was the reporting. And there's an accounting accountability that was not there, and that's a healthy thing. I mean, the media has gone through enough scandals the last few years. The big one at my paper, of course, was the Jason Blair scandal, in a case in which a young reporter was found to have plagiarized and, in some cases, made up numerous stories. You know, those have been issues of real reckoning for the media. in a time of economic distress when our business model is been in real jeopardy and there's question about whether we'll survive, you know, newspapers and editors and reporters realize that we have to do a better job of letting people know how we go about gathering the news. We have to be more transparent. We have to tell people when we are quoting someone anonymously why we're doing that. I think that's a healthy, evolving process. That brings me to some of the big confrontations we've had the last few years over stories like the NSA wiretapping program. And that was one unlike anything I think that I'll ever be involved in personally. My partner at the paper, Jim Reise, and I began hearing rumblings really in around 2004 about some mysterious intelligence program in the government that was causing really intense anxiety. We weren't quite sure what it was or what the anxieties were, but there was a real palpable nervousness out there about something involving this mystery intelligence gathering program. And we began poking around on this, it was slow going. I mean, this was, you would get a lot of blank stares when you asked about this, or worse yet, you would get, scornful looks like, go away, don't even ask about that. Eventually, though, we were able to gather enough information to realize that what this was a program ordered by the president himself to basically circumvent the court process that had been put in place after Watergate to have some judicial review over wiretapping. What President Bush had done was to, under the mantle of Commander-in-Chief and his constitutional authorities, claim the power to order wiretaps of Americans in their international communications without a court order. And this was obviously a huge sea change. I had been covering at that point the Patriot Act debate for a number of years, and that was already a raging debate about the balance between civil liberties and national security. In comparison, the NSA program dwarfed that. This was the 800-pound gorilla compared to really the minutiae of the Patriot Act, which involved expanding the government's powers, but doing it with the oversight of the courts. So here you have this little box involving what can the government do and how far can it stretch civil liberties. And then over here you had this enormous secret program which made a mockery of sort of the public debate. And as we pressed forward, we eventually went to the White House to ask for comment. It sounds a little comical, but would you like to comment on this story? And the White House pushed back with such ferocity, demanding meetings with the top editors, explaining the dangers that publication of this program would do to national security. Bill Keller, our editor then and now, said he had never seen anything like it in recent history of the newspaper in terms of the high level lobbying that was going on from the White House in terms of both numbers and intensity. And in the first go-round in the story, it worked. The editors decided that this was not a story that they were comfortable running, that there was too great a harm to national security. I did not agree with that decision. Jim Reisen, my partner, didn't agree with that decision. Neither did the immediate line editor on the story. But I recognized that this was a difficult decision in a difficult time. Again, remember the climate. This was 2004 when the newspaper first made that decision. And as folks on the left like to remind us, it was right around the time of the 2004 election that this decision was made. We would get beat up badly by the left after the story finally ran for allegedly holding the story and giving the election to George Bush. Whether that's true or not in terms of how that might have affected the election, what I do know is that the election itself was more an annoyance in the timing of whether or not to run the story. It was sort of just by freak occurrence that we were having this discussion in September and October and November of 2004. And there was certainly no grand design here to run the story or not run the story to influence or affect the election. It was an unfortunate circumstance of timing more than anything else. But ultimately, the paper decided to hold off on the story. I believed then, and continue to believe today, that the substance of the story, in terms of intelligence gathering, did no tangible harm to national security. That's a point of contention, and there are folks to this day on the right who will say that the story did harm. My belief is that it was widely known to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden that the United States was using every tool in its toolbox to wiretap them. There had been thousands of stories about U.S. intelligence gathering efforts, some involving the NSA, many involving the FBI, to intercept, eavesdrop, wiretap Al-Qaeda communications. What was not known, the secret here, was not that we were trying to wiretap Americans. The secret was that the president had allowed the NSA to do that on Americans without using a court order. As I said, the editors were not persuaded, and the story sat. The story held for 14 months until we revisited this issue, partly because, as I discuss in my book, my partner Jim Risen was working on a book of his own and was considering putting this information in his book, which was tantamount to turning in his resignation at the paper. I mean, he realized the gravity of what he's doing, but he also realized that this was an important public policy issue that was being kept secret from the American people. You know, we never decide our own minds in reporting the story. Is this legal or illegal? Is it right or wrong? You know, that's not our job as reporters. What we saw our job as was to put information out to the public, so long as it did not harm national security, that would inform the public, inform the debate that was going on about this tenuous balance between national security and civil liberties and how the war on terror was being fought. Ultimately, our argument won out. The editors came to realize, partly through our additional reporting, that this was a program that had caused such intense angst within the administration itself that there were a number of senior lawyers in the Justice Department in the Bush administration who believed this program was illegal. And I think it was that realization that helped push the story over the edge and got it in the paper finally in December of 2005. And after the publication, that nervousness, those concerns internally about the possibility that this was an illegal program became even more magnified. I did the first story on what's now become the famous hospital visit to John Ashcroft's bedside by Alberto Gonzalez and Andy Card, who were then at the White House. Gonzalez was then the White House counsel. Andy Card was then the chief of staff to George Bush. This scene out of The Godfather, I remember the first time I heard someone telling me about this, they wouldn't get into the details. They just said that Gonzalez and Card were at Ashcroft's hospital one night, and you should find out why they were there. And I'm picturing Alberto Gonzalez with a stethoscope in hospital garb and trying to figure out like what was he doing there. And it was a period of weeks before we got a better sense of what this was about. And what this was about is, as you may know if you follow this piece of the story, was that Gonzalez and Card had gone to Ashcroft's hospital room when he was in intensive care and even more seriously ill than we realized at the time, and had tried to persuade him to overrule his deputy and to sign on to the continued operations of the program. The way the program was set up, the Justice Department every 45 days had to put its signature saying that this is a legal and constitutional program. This had gone on secretly for 2.5 years at that point, and it had been basically sort of a rubber stamp, an Ashcroft's pile of papers. He would sign his name. Now he had a new deputy who said, hang on, we think this program might be illegal, and we have real concerns about the original legal opinions that were signed. This was a lawyer at the Justice Department who's now also become somewhat famous, John Yoo, who signed many of the early legal opinions justifying both broad surveillance tactics and also in harsh interrogation techniques under the president's commander-in-chief power. John Yoo was the go-to guy for the White House, who had such a broad reading of presidential power that it was really an anything goes attitude at the Justice Department, and I talk extensively about that in my book as well. Then you had a new cast of characters beginning in 2003 and 2004, began looking through the files and were really stopped by just how far these legal opinions had gone, and they began literally rewriting them. And it was that trend that led to this dramatic hospital scene where Ashcroft was literally on his pillow having to decide whether to stand by his deputy, who thought this program was illegal, or the White House, which was saying, sign this or Americans will die. And Ashcroft, who had never really shown any resistance to the program before this, in the telling of the witnesses who were there, rose his head off the pillow, again a scene out of Hollywood, and said, well, I'm not the Attorney General at the moment. The Attorney General, the acting Attorney General, is over there, and he says he's not going to do it, and that's the decision. So it really became, in terms of human drama, the telltale moment in the whole sequence of the NSA program, and that's a scene which I sort of keep getting drawn back to in my reporting. It's the touchstone that I can't escape. I did a story just a few days ago where there was a new report about Alberto Gonzalez, who just can't seem to keep himself out of trouble even after he left the Attorney General's spot. A whole new problem for him came up in a report from the Inspector General a few days ago, where he had mishandled classified information and was under criminal investigation for this. And the classified information, come to find out that he had mishandled, was his handwritten account of that weekend where he had visited Ashcroft in the hospital and then had briefed, briefed congressional leaders on this crisis, this revolt in the Justice Department over the NSA wiretapping program. And Gonzalez had, at the president's order, had given a handwritten account of this, which included numerous classified, not just classified, but the above top secret clearance about the program itself, and had taken these documents home with him. And he was so protective of them in almost a paranoid way that when he moved from the White House as White House counsel to the Justice Department as Attorney General in 2005, that was the one and only document he took with him, was his secret handwritten account of what happened over the NSA wiretapping program. And he put it in a double envelope and sealed it, and he said, for Attorney General's eyes only. And then he put it in his house, and then he put it in a safe, and the Inspector General ultimately found that this was a classified document which he was in potentially criminal violation of having mishandled. So yet another sort of fascinating turn in the story for me. So this was the ultimate test of this balance I've talked about between the public's right to know and national security. But, we found ourselves in other situations as well. About 6 months after the NSA story, we had a second parallel program, secret program, that we had learned about, again, my partner Jim Risen and I, which involved the surveillance of international banking records. The government was using a Belgium cooperative, which was the routing point for billions and billions of transfers, mostly international transfers, but every major bank in the world uses this clearinghouse for its transfers. And this was a program that, again, it caused serious unrest within the government. The Belgian cooperative at one point worried that it was in danger of being charged with illegally giving information to the U.S. government, and it threatened to bail out of the program altogether. The White House was so worried about this back in 2003 that they were going to lose their partner that they flew all the directors into Washington and had face-to-face emergency meetings with everyone in the government, from Alan Greenspan to Condi Rice to Bob Mueller at the FBI. They had milk and cookies with Mueller at the FBI to urge them not to leave this program, that their contribution was too vital. And again, this is not a program that we as reporters viewed as legal or illegal or proper or improper. Those are not our decisions to make. But it was of a piece with this really raging debate at that point. This was now in 2006 that we were working on that story, the raging debate over the war on terror and where that balance should be struck and the presidential powers that the White House had claimed. I think that's an important point also to remember in discussing why we ultimately ran these stories, is that the context for all this is the enormous power grab by the White House in terms of it's often just complete disregard for the normal checks and balances. I think a lot of these programs, which have now become so controversial, the NSA wiretapping, the interrogation practices and harsh interrogation practices at Guantanamo and Iraq and elsewhere, a lot of these things would have been much more palatable and would have probably withstood scrutiny had the White House been more open to working with Congress and working with the courts. And I discuss this at some length in my book, that the secrecy and almost paranoia that infected the White House, and a lot of this came out of Vice President Cheney's office, really was its Achilles heel, because they were programs that it could have gotten through, that it could have achieved with relatively little controversy, had they just been willing to rein themselves in and work with Congress, work with the courts, and really engage the public in a discussion about the war on terror. But there was an absolute refusal to do that, mostly from the Vice President's office, in this wartime footing, secrecy was paramount. There was a distrust of Congress. Cheney had and has a deeply held conviction that Congress cannot be trusted with secret information, and was willing to really, in some cases, outwardly violate laws that require that the full intelligence committees be briefed. For instance, in the NSA program, clearly, by a report that's now come out, it was clear that both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees should have been briefed in this program. There should have been an oversight process. The White House said, we're not doing that. At first, they didn't. Initially, they only told four members of Congress what they're doing. They brought them into Cheney's office. Cheney briefed them personally with the top intelligence officers there, wouldn't allow them to take notes about what they were hearing, wouldn't allow them to tell their staff, wouldn't allow them to consult with their lawyers about what was going on. It gave them a very limited, filtered view of this NSA wiretapping program and what the government was doing. Gradually, they let eight members of Congress know about it as concerns were raised. But there was never the full briefings of the intelligence committees and the normal oversight that would provide a check and balance for a program like this. And in interviewing people, both for the newspaper and for my book, this became a real source of friction for people working within the administration. A lot of these folks were true believers, and I don't question their integrity or their righteousness in this, but true believers that the nation is and was at war, that we had to take extraordinary aggressive steps to stop the next attack. But many of these folks also became equally uncomfortable with the idea of this go-it-alone approach, this muscularity that the White House was exhibiting in saying, we're going to do it, and we're going to do it our way, and Congress be damned, and the courts be damned. And eventually that caught up to them. We began to see court decisions in 2004 and 2005. The Hamdan decision was one of the famous ones, where Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that a state of war is not a blank check for the White House to do whatever it wants. And that was really a seminal moment. That was when the normal equilibrium of government began to reestablish itself. Folks in Congress and folks in the courts, as cases began to percolate through the courts, again had some role in providing a check on what was going on. And grudgingly, the White House has had to really adapt its attitude and live in this new world, this new realization that the president's commander-in-chief power does not give him the authority to do literally whatever he wants. In the end, there were checks reinstituted. But the flip side to that is that through its political power, the White House has still managed to maintain good chunks of that authority that it claimed by playing the war on terror card. The best example, I know I keep coming back to the NSA wiretapping story, but that's the best example of it, where after about 2 years of debate following our story, and every proposal in the world thrown out for how Congress should respond to this, from banning the program altogether to giving the president even more power, the administration finally agreed to put the NSA wiretapping program back under court oversight, where it originally would have been, and Congress ultimately agreed to give the president most of the power he had already claimed on his own. And the key thing you may remember there was that Congress also agreed to give immunity to AT&T and the other telecom companies that had secretly taken part in this. That was the White House's main goal in all of this, was to protect its partners in the program, which were facing some 40 lawsuits at that point, claiming billions of dollars in damages for privacy violations over this wiretapping program. In the end, the White House won out. For a period of months, the Democrats had pushed back and had said, you know, we're not going to give you what you want. And they played this game of chicken for about 6 months through the end of last year and early this year. And for a while, the authority for the wiretapping program was even allowed to expire. But in the end, the White House, as it often does, stood its ground. The Democrats backed down, and the president got just about everything he wanted and more. And I think that the politics of that are fascinating, where the Democrats still have not figured out a way to make themselves, to stand up to the White House without fear of looking soft on terrorism. And to this day, that's obviously an issue for Barack Obama in the presidential race. That's the issue that one of the main issues that McCain will be hitting the next 2 months is who can better protect the country. McCain has a view of presidential power almost as broad as President Bush's. The key exception is the area of torture interrogation, where McCain was the main driver behind additional restrictions and an outright ban on what could be considered torture. But in terms of presidential power, there's little reason to think that his view will be much different than President Bush's, and Obama and the Democrats have not really figured out a way to counter that. In fact, on the NSA wiretapping vote, when that finally came to a vote, Obama had been threatening, you may recall, for months to filibuster the bill, to stand on the Senate for hours and hours if it took, so that the phone companies would not get immunity and so that the president would not get the wiretapping power that he wanted. Well, then in the end, when the actually came to a vote, Obama reversed himself and he voted for the bill, he voted for the immunity and for the power that the president was claiming. And this was, the latest in a whole line of political tests where the Democrats just struggle to figure out where their comfort point is going to be and how they make themselves look something other than soft on terrorism. So I've droned on long enough here, and I'd be glad to take whatever questions you had. Just no spitballs. That's all I ask. So,
Eric, let me prime the pump if I can. You identify one of the important dilemmas, and that is starting with the Batty case in Southwest Virginia. You identify a significant number of errors that the administration made in picking up people, holding people, detaining people for a period of time. In looking back at the history of this sort of situation, it looks like this administration has made far fewer mistakes than Lincoln made during the Civil War or were made during the Red Scare, the Palmer Raids. We didn't have a massive roundup like we did at the end of or during World War II with the Japanese. We didn't have the problems that we encountered during the McCarthy era. Obviously, in times of war, there's going to be some error rate. My view as a poor golfer has been that if you don't put a few in the woods, you're never going to get some birdies, you know. And there are going to be mistakes made, but Ron Susskind identified the Cheney vision that if there's a 1% chance that a particular attack will succeed, we have to put a stop to it. What is the current thinking in Washington about what level of error rate is acceptable?
Right. Well, no, that's a fascinating question, and you've hit the nail on the head with the 1% doctrine, which really did dominate the administration's thinking for at least the first 4 or 5 years after 9/11. The idea that if there was any possibility that an individual or a group represented a threat, a 1% chance that in the case that the George referred to, Taj Bhatti, a guy who lived down in Southwest Virginia in Appalachia, that he was a real terrorist, that 1% threat had to be treated as a 100% threat. And that has serious implications for the balance of reasonable doubt and what it takes to incarcerate someone. In terms of whether or not this compares or how it compares to earlier roundups, World War II with Japanese internment camps, I would agree that in terms of numbers, we have not seen, we've seen probably, by my best estimate, probably about 4,000 people on U.S. soil who were incarcerated after 9/11 on dubious charges, and I'm counting there about 1,300 illegal immigrants who were in fact rounded up in the weeks and months after 9/11. Almost all of them Middle Eastern Arab or Arab descent or Muslims, and none of them turned out to have any connection to terrorism. Yet they were held for, in some cases, 8-9 months at a time without being charged, incommunicado, without access to their families. Their families would ask where they were being held, and they had just disappeared. They were, for a time, the INS was simply telling people they didn't know when they would ask about their cousin, their husband, their father, we don't know who you're talking about. These people were treated as terrorist suspects for little or no connection to terrorism, and ultimately they were all simply deported as illegal immigrants, but not as terrorists. That was, in some ways, I think, an inevitable response to 9/11. It's one that government investigations since then have found to be, in some ways, reckless. But that's a tough call, where certainly the risk that the government was willing to take after 9/11, and even today is willing to take, of locking up the wrong person is greater than it was before 9/11. That's a risk that many are willing to take in order to stop the next attack, but I think that knowing where that balance is has been an agonizing and difficult process for folks at the FBI in particular and the Justice Department.
Hi. Mr. Lischblau, thank you for your good talk, and I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
I'm going to press you a little bit on the matter that you just raised. I think in your talk, you talked about it as well, that in the period immediately after 9/11, where we had no idea of how extensive Al-Qaeda had penetrated the United States, even if it had, the reaction of the government to round up people, as you suggest, to take the suggestion from NSA to try this program, to see if they could find people in the United States who were in touch with Al-Qaeda people, as your paper ultimately decided, admittedly with great pressure, there was a period of time where we really didn't know. We, American citizenry and our top officials, didn't know what the answer to this question was.
Absolutely.
And part of what you're saying is then there comes a time after the period, after a year or two has passed, when there haven't been any further attacks, no more further evidence of conspiracies, where we sort of go back to the regular order. Now, don't you think a lot of what happened in the NSA case started out this way, and then was introduced this view that, as a matter of fact, we can use this particular incident as a way to further extend presidential power? That kind of ideological mindset seemed to set in, because as you also said, when the Congress had a chance to think this thing through, what the remedy was. Of course the remedy was to bring in the FISA court. Of course the remedy was to get some kind of review of what these phone calls meant. And as you point out, it came out well in the end. The problem was it took too long.
I agree completely, and that's one of the main themes of my book, is the idea that the initial response to 9/11 was by the government was in many ways understandable, predictable, overdue, necessary. Everyone in government in Washington believed there was a second wave of attacks that was coming. It was not a question of if, it was when. You know, there were more sleeper cells. There were more Al-Qaeda plots on the way. That was seen as a certainty, and that drove the response after 9/11. I think where the administration went off track, and this, again, is a theme of my book, is that once that initial crisis period passed in 2002, early 2003, people in the government began to say, wow, we somehow dodged that second bullet. Thank God. We don't know how. Was it better offense by the U.S.? Was it better defense? Was it a more aware public? Was it that Al-Qaeda is still looming and plotting? We don't know, but we dodged that bullet. Now what do we do? And the response from the White House, again, clearly driven by Cheney's office, is that we stay on wartime footing forever. There was the in effect, the declaration of a permanent state of war. And that was something that many within the government, who I talked to on a regular basis, were uncomfortable with. There was a pushback with the NSA program, which I know I keep coming back to, and torture and interrogation and detainees and a whole range of things, where folks in the government, and I'm not talking about card-carrying ACLU members, that you have to realize these were conservatives. These were conservatives arguing with people who were even more conservative. And the moderate conservatives, if you want to call them that, were the ones saying, do we really want to live in this permanent state of war forever? Or do we want to sort of get back to the balance and start institutionalizing some of this stuff, start going to Congress, start getting the clear legal authority to do what we're doing? And the White House for a long, long time was unwilling and unable to do that until it was forced by the courts with a gun to its head, basically. I argue that that was a mistake, that that was a tactical mistake by the White House.
I'd like for you to comment on what I see as a systematic flaw in the journalism that I'm exposed to, and that would be a lack of historical context, background information, and how that relates to your reporting. And I guess an example would be maybe a footnote in your speech, which was the latest Gonzalez gaffe, I guess, and the fact that until today I didn't know what the documents were that he had been hiding.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that we should, as far as the historical context, that we should play those stories up bigger or provide more history? Tell me what we should be doing differently.
Right. What I'm saying is that without the knowledge of what the documents were in the Gonzalez case, the public has a difficult time understanding.
Right. Well, I've only done one story on that. It ran, I guess it was Wednesday's paper. I'm sure it's still online. I mean, that was all in the story that I did, and most of the other media stories I saw certainly included that. The headlines were that the former attorney general mishandled classified evidence, and the stories described that the evidence he was mishandling was this secret handwritten accounting of the NSA program. So I think that was in the stories. And if you read a story that didn't have that, I'd be surprised. But it certainly should. It was certainly in my story, prominently in my story. So if you could go online and just Google it.
I'm a firm believer that an informed public is really critical to democracy. So I appreciate all that you and other reporters have done to keep us informed. But I'm also curious as to what you think the damage has been done to our democracy because of these policies.
Well, I think that there are a lot of people within the Justice Department, again, which is my main beat and my main focus, who believe it will take a long time to recover from some of the quick, in some ways reckless, legal opinions that were written soon after 9/11. And John Yoo is usually bears the blame for a lot of that, even in the view of his former colleagues. Distrust that those legal opinions and legal policies justified in terms of policies for torture and surveillance, you know, is still very prevalent even in the Justice Department today. And I think that it will be, in assessing the damage, I think there's still a lot we don't know, to be honest. And there are numerous records that still remain secret. There are probably numerous programs that still remain secret and that we may only find out years from now. You know, remember in the Vietnam Watergate era, you know, it took the Church and Pike Commissions, you know, in some cases 10, 20, 30 years to look back historically on what the CIA and the NSA and the FBI were doing. And it, you know, it may take that long again just to even know what was going on, much less assess the damage.
Thank you very much for your presentation. In the interest of full disclosure, let me begin my remark by commenting that for 40 years I was with the Department of Justice in charge of international and national security work. I was in Europe at the time, stationed there at 9/11. Two comments that don't necessarily go into anything substantively that you said, but I think is appropriate to at least integrate into your consideration. One is that the so-called Bush-Cheney extension of presidential powers did not originate in the Bush administration. If you go back to the early 70s during the Nixon administration, when the Department of Justice was pressing very hard for a federal wiretap statute for criminal prosecutions, you'll notice that what emerged from Congress at the time was a caveat in that provision, which said that the criminal electronic surveillance that we're authorizing does not impact on any potential presidential powers that he may have with respect to national security issues. So this was an issue that was on the table going back to early 1970 with respect to the president's power to conduct electronic surveillance for national security purposes without judicial supervision. Mm-hmm. That was point one. Point two, I don't think you can isolate 9/11 and disregard what occurred overseas with respect to terrorist attacks on American interests, American allies. Sure. I'm thinking particularly about the London attacks, the Spain attacks, the Bali attacks. Mm-hmm. These all reflect on the nature of the threat that we are facing and still face. So I do think it is a question of taking a world or a broader view of what our response should be and what is the nature of the threat. I will say that Secretary Chertoff was the first to voice the opinion that we cannot protect ourselves from every threat and we're going to have to choose. And that is where we stand now as far as I'm concerned. So I make these remarks just as comments to round out the information presented. Thank you.
Sure, and I agree on just about all the points you made. I think that people like Secretary Chertoff have brought a somewhat different mindset. That, you know, we talked earlier about the 1% doctrine. Chertoff is on the other side with the idea that there has to be some an acceptance of some risk ratio. You know, you could throw all the resources of government at stopping the next attack. You could seal off the borders. You could tap every phone call. You could look at every piece of financial data that flows through the system. And at some point, Americans have to ask themselves how much we're willing to sacrifice in the way of civil liberties and what level of risk are we willing to accept to sort of maintain the society that we expect. And I think I agree to a point that this can't be looked at just through a U.S. prism, but certainly 9/11, you know, it's a cliche, changed everything for us. And what I've seen in my coverage is that, you know, the Europeans kind of, and you would have a better take than I would on this, but the Europeans sort of look at us a bit curiously since 9/11 in terms of just how far we have transformed our system of government in response to 9/11. The Europeans, I think, have, and stop me if you disagree, but have accepted more of a level of risk. That's not to say that anyone wants to see another Bali or Madrid or London, but through things like the IRA bombings, et cetera, have grown to accept that that is sometimes the unfortunate part of modern society without completely disrupting everything else.
What is the role and responsibility of Congress members who are given information that their colleagues do not have? And are you aware of any Congress members who did have information about this program who wrestled with this question of holding it or sharing it with their colleagues?
They were in a very, very tough spot, and the one who voiced the greatest reservations was Senator Rockefeller from West Virginia, who was the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. And he was very concerned after one briefing, a private briefing by Vice President Cheney. Again, he had been sworn to secrecy, could not take any notes about this meeting, could not talk to his aides. What he did do was to write a personal letter to Vice President Cheney. This was in 2003. Saying that he was disturbed by what he'd heard about this wiretapping program, and that it seemed to fall in the area of things that Congress had expressly banned. You may remember something called the Total Information Awareness Program, which the military began, John Poindexter, Iran-Contra fame, began this program to sort of grab every bit of data in cyberspace and compile profiles on Americans and non-Americans to sort of predict the next Muhammad Atta. And Congress, when they found out about this, expressly banned it. Rockefeller's concern was that this newfangled NSA program came dangerously close to being exactly that. And he expressed those reservations, sent the letter to Cheney, kept a copy for himself, and locked it in his safe and never told anyone else about it. But that's as far as it went. You can voice those reservations, but none of them took the additional step of in effect outing the program or doing something about it.
For his skill as a reporter and his judgment and his courage, Eric Lischblau and his partner at the New York Times, James Risen, were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting in 2006. We're very grateful that you were here, and we're grateful for what you do. Thank you.